Okay, so we might as well get going. So lots of fun things to do today, too. But just to remind you, we've had a number of emails about this, and I think some anxiety with people. Because there's only three exams, there's a lot of material in this next exam, right? Yes. So just to remind you, if you look at the syllabus up here, where did we take our last wonderful test? Okay. Up here, you know, around 213 that week. And remember, all your exams are up there from exam one. And the podcast, something happened with the echo on section four when we went over the exam. But at least you have the test. You just click on that, and then the podcast is there. Also, remember the assignment, the lecture assignment that we want to start working on so you can get your full 10 points, right? Everybody should get 10 points on that. It's not too hard to do. It'll be fun. And so just click on that and look that up. And then there's a fun little YouTube video that you can watch right there. That's pretty cool, actually. But look how much material is on this next exam. Sensory, muscle, behavior. We're going to do a little catch-up here. And then more behavior. And then we start some endocrine. Wow. And then, you know, your lecture assignment's due before spring break, so you'll have a break. And then, you know, yeah, don't have to study over spring break much for that lecture assignment. But what are you going to be doing over spring break? You are going to be studying a little bit, hopefully reviewing some of all this material. And then the endocrine, there's actually quite a bit in the endocrine. And it depends on how far we get, but I imagine we're going to do a little bit of cardiovascular before this exam, and then the exam is going to be in here. But what I hope to do is to spend that time in the sections, right, in the lab sections, and have review sessions. So we got, you know, 3 hours for every section that week. So that week, we're going to go into the labs and review, right? Review, review, review. So we just continually go over stuff, and hopefully that'll help, too. We can go over old exams if you want to as well, whatever you want to do there. So hopefully that week will be very useful, but try to come prepared for that those sections, because then we just it's for your time to ask questions, right? And then we have the exam in here, and we got an hour and, you know, whatever, 15 minutes or something. But that time goes fast, and as you know. All right? Question.
I was absent that day that you talked about the lecture assignment. Is that like a bonus assignment?
Or no, that's part of our... the points. Remember in lecture we have, what, 60 points or something like that? And that's, you know, these 10 points are these quizzes. So you can get your 10 points there. Right? Okay. It's all on. Echo. What is it again? It's magic. Yeah. It's due before spring break, right?
Can
so you can enjoy spring break and study for
review.
Yes.
Can it be like a review article, or does it have to be a primary?
It'd be great if it was a primary article for you, but if it's a review article, that's okay too, because, you know, that kind of gives you a good view. And remember, there's so many good things out there. Let's look at Science Daily that just came out this morning, I think. Human neural stem cell grafts to repair spinal cord injuries in monkeys. I mean, that's cool stuff, right? So you start to think about, there are so many papers that you can pull up, so many articles that are really neat. I don't know if you saw that just came out in UK now, but they had this little article about this meeting that they're having here, I think this Saturday. It's too expensive to go to, actually, but they're actually having a meeting about smell right here. And just like we talked about, they're bringing in people that are master chefs and cooks and the Woodford distillery person, and they're actually bringing that in about smell and taste. And so they're actually having a meal that's supposed to be... made. I'm not going. I'm going to the science fair we have, the regional science fair at Dunbar this weekend to help judge there. But just something to think about that we just mentioned about this, about the smell, and talking about rodents versus humans. And what did they say here? This is kind of cool. Where did it go? So, mice have roughly 1,000 odor receptors, and humans only have 350. We're just pathetic compared to the little mouse, right? So it's kind of neat, but mostly volatile substances. So again, just what we talked about. So maybe somebody finds something interesting about that. I thought this was pretty cool. I was going to show this before class, but this is so neat. Look at this little bird. This guy flies around in his little plane. Have you seen this before? Isn't this cool? And this relates to muscle. It's not a total tangent. think about these migratory birds, and we'll talk about them a little bit. Wouldn't that be so cool to be on a little plane with that? You get to pet the bird in the air. Bonds with them.
Oh, he raised them?
Yeah. And then he works with them, and then he gets up and flies with them, and he brings different people up on his plane.
Oh, awesome.
Let's do this.
Is that not cool?
That is so cool. Next one.
We need a field trip to go do that.
Seems very safe.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And the end of the movie, you see the plane go to propellers and just get shot up. No, I'm joking. Sorry, that was bad. Make sure you're paying attention. That's just fantastic. So you think about the muscles in these birds, right? How are they migratory, and how are they flying so far? And some things to think about that we will talk about. Okay. So Silence Daily, there's lots of neat things out there that you can be looking up, and, you know, look at your syllabus there. All right. And off to where we go with muscle. So muscle, just think of muscle. It's fantastic, right? It's the largest organ in your body, the most mass of your body. Could you live without muscle? Skeletal muscle? No. And cardiac muscle, we're going to talk a little bit about. And then you think of smooth muscle. Smooth muscle is where? GI tract, blood vessels, right? And so we'll be talking a little bit about smooth muscle. Not too much about smooth muscle, but any of these topics you can imagine. A whole course on cardiac muscle, a whole one on smooth muscle, a whole one on skeletal muscle. We actually have a course in skeletal muscle. We taught it last semester. It's the first time it was taught. There is a group here, actually, the Center of Muscle Biology. So you can look that up on the webpage. And it's with people from, I think, 9 different departments across campus, cardiovascular surgeons to people taking muscle samples out of donor hearts and finding out why they didn't work anymore, and then looking at them in a lab and finding out what might be wrong with those ion channels or so. And then there's people that are working in there with rehabilitation sciences, how muscles regenerate. And then athletic training group is actually involved as well. So exercising with muscle, and why does muscle atrophy when you get old? It doesn't really matter. I won't say how old I am. But after 50, supposedly, your skeletal muscles just start to atrophy. And it really doesn't matter if you exercise that much or not. They're going to still atrophy unless you're doing something illegal like injecting steroids or other things if you're training for some sport. But there's a lot to this, and you wonder, why do you atrophy so much? So what happens with older people? You know, the big risk is fall risk, right? And it's because of weak muscles. So it's kind of interesting. And I think I mentioned that, you know, UK, Kentucky is number one or number two with West Virginia for what? Pancreatic cancer, right? And there's something very odd with pancreatic cancer, and they can't quite figure this out. And the Cancer Institute over here is working on it with the director, Mark Evers. And he actually moved here from Houston because of the cancer, high cancer incidence that's here. This is why we have a cancer recognition of a national institute. It's kind of bad that we have it because we're here because we have so much cancer, okay? But pancreatic cancer is very bad. Usually if you're diagnosed with it or somebody's diagnosed, it's usually very late and they tell you you have 3 to 6 months to live, basically, because it's usually that kind of late kind of problem. But a number of people don't die from the pancreatic cancer. They actually die from muscle weakness. They die because their diaphragm becomes too weak. It actually atrophies, and their skeletal muscles atrophy. And they can't really figure out why the connection with pancreatic cancer and your skeletal muscles are weak. And sometimes people are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer because they come in because of their muscles are weak, and they're having problems breathing, and they're having problems with exercise, and they feel fatigued. And then they find out, oh, your muscles are really weak. Now, what's the problem? And then they find out they have pancreatic cancer, and it's kind of usually too late. So it's kind of interesting to think, what's that connection? One of the treatments they're actually using is a drug called rapamycin. And maybe some of you have heard of this compound. They actually use it to help stop cells from multiplying. So there's a pathway in your cells that you might remember from cell, if you had cell, is, you know, how does a cell recognize that it has glucose, right? Energy. How does it know it has stores in there? And how does it know it needs to start making proteins? Well, there are pathways inside the cell, right? Everything that you remembered and forgot in the cell. But one of those pathways uses mTOR. And mTOR is a kind of a main key part of the cell for energy regulation. And there's a drug that works on that mTOR to stop cells from dividing, stop cells from growing, and it's called rapamycin. It's so bizarre. A group of people went to Easter Island, you know, way off in the South Pacific where those big statues are, you know, those carven statues where they're still trying to figure out where they came from and all that. And they happened to culture the soil on there to find out what kind of microbes might be on Easter Island. And they found this one weird bacteria that happens when they isolated the compounds from the bacteria that stops cells from growing. Is that not weird? And that's rapamycin. So mTOR is the target of rapamycin. That's why they named it that. So target of rapamycin. So cancer patients get rapamycin, but then what happens? Other cells don't divide. But maybe your cancer cells, you know, aren't dividing. That's good. But then what happens if you damage your skeletal muscle? What happens if you damage your GI tract and you need to proliferate those cells, right? So those are inhibited too. So you see the trade-off that's going on, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about. But people are wondering that maybe it's not so good to use rapamycin because your skeletal muscles atrophy even more, or they're not repairing because you're on rapamycin. Just things to think about, you know, the bigger picture. It's really quite neat that this is being used and you hear about it. People use it in research experiments because they want to stop cells from dividing, for example. So they might use rapamycin. You might use it sometime if you're working in a lab. Skeletal muscle, just phenomenal, right? You work out, you exercise. How does muscle grow? Anybody have an idea? How does muscle grow? Do you increase the number of cells? Or does the cell get bigger? How do your muscles grow? Isn't that bizarre?
Doesn't the muscle like rip apart and then it like repairs itself, but it doesn't go exactly back? It like has to form bridges to get back to each other.
Okay, so the point was that maybe it rips apart and then it forms bridges to come back together. That's kind of interesting too. Hold that thought. Any other thoughts? How do you build muscle? How does muscle grow? Let's say we started exercising. And it's really weird, if you start lifting weights with your right arm, your other muscles increase in size too. Isn't that interesting? So think about somebody that's maybe had a broken arm and they're not using their muscle and it atrophies very quick, right? Anybody ever break an arm or a leg, put it in a cast? What happened to your muscles? Right? Shrinks. But if you would exercise, you can't exercise maybe your broken arm because the bone's not connected in and it's in a cast, right? They might give you a little ball to move around in your fingers to keep the blood circulating and trying to keep the muscles moving a little bit. But you don't want to undo the set bone, for example, right? So hopefully a lot of physicians now are telling people to exercise with their other limbs if you have something that's in a cast because you can try to keep that muscle healthy. Let's think about that too. So muscle growth, we had one idea. Anybody else ideas? Muscle growth? You're just going to love that course next semester you want to take, right? Muscle physiology, a whole semester. Muscle, skeletal muscle. All right. Okay. Any other ideas? Do you think it's cell numbers increase? Somebody thinks cell numbers increase. Maybe. Okay. Mass increase? Maybe just magic. Okay. So actually, it's really interesting. You don't really increase the number of cells. You increase the mass of the cell that's in there. You increase the contractile elements inside of that muscle fiber. And we're going to talk about that as we go along. But just store that in the back of your brain, how odd that is. You have a muscle cell that's contracting and moving. We're going to talk about this part. And then you add contracting elements to a muscle that can contract and move at the same time. And when you atrophy, you're still using your muscle, but parts of the cell is actually degrading while the muscle's still working. That's pretty bizarre, right? So just think about how that works, and it's really something. And to understand how muscles grow, actually, some of the key elements in understanding how you add elements into a skeletal muscle, like the contractile elements, while the muscle's growing, right? How do you add to it? Actually, some of the primary work in understanding that came from Drosophila work, because you could actually tag particular proteins and actually see how they're moving in to the contractile element. And a guy did that at Harvard. And it's really cool. So that work that was done in Drosophila, growing Drosophila maggots, larvae, was actually key in understanding how your muscles grow and how they add together and elements in disease states as well. So Drosophila is a key element in actually looking at disease states and muscle development in atrophy. Really quite neat. So it kind of sets the pace for this chapter, that there's so many neat aspects in this chapter, but we can't spend a tremendous amount of time. We only have a certain amount of time to go over things. So when you're a little one in your mama's belly, these little myoblasts are coming together, and they're actually fusing together, and they make this myotube. And the myotube, your muscles, your skeletal muscles, are actually a group of cells that have fused together. So this is really odd, because your skeletal muscle is actually multinucleated. It has multiple nuclei. And the reason it has multiple nuclei is because it's a fusion of cells that came together. And that's pretty odd to think about, because you think of a nucleus, you know, giving rise to the proteins and regulation for that cell. So is every nucleus the same across the whole cell? What do you think? You got a long muscle fiber here, and you got multiple nuclei in there, maybe 20 or so. Are they all going to be the same? What regulates one over the other? Are they all making the same amount of proteins? Is that not bizarre? It's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, you think about that, it's bizarre. Actually, they're different. They're different in what they make. Underneath the neuromuscular junction, they make different proteins than they do out in the side. There's a different amount of activity right underneath the neuromuscular junction of that nuclei compared to others in that same cell. And they think it's a local regulation of that activity and actually signals that come from the nerve to that muscle that activate those nuclei different from the other nuclei. That's really wild. And some of that work was actually done in invertebrates to understand that component. So again, that comparative nature is really quite cool. So then you wonder, how do you add more myotubes together? So one myotube is usually giving a foundation for the next myotube to grow, and that's pretty neat. And then you get multiple myotubes inside of kind of a wrapping that goes around the muscle fiber. But what's also really interesting are these cells, satellite cells. These satellite cells sit underneath the plasma membrane, underneath the basal lamina, and they can actually divide and then make a new stem cell, a new satellite cell that's waiting there. But then that satellite cell can actually help to make another muscle aspect in there. It invaginates inside that cell and can add nuclei to that muscle. That's really amazing. But they found out that you can actually, as you develop, you need these satellite cells. But after you develop, after you're finished developing, then you actually don't need the satellite cells so much. And Charlotte Peterson over here in the Rehabilitation Sciences, her group actually works on this. And she's published some of the seminal papers that are world recognized on satellite cells in muscle physiology. So if you're interested in muscle work and you want to work in someone's lab and understand more about skeletal muscle and clinical applications, look up the Center of Muscle Biology. Some really good people over there. Tim Butterfield and Esther DuPont Van Steeden, I know it's a long name, they just got like a $1.6 million grant to actually understand how massage of skeletal muscle changes muscle growth. And, you know, everybody kind of poo-poo, maybe massages, it's kind of, you know, hokey. But actually they found out that the mechanosensory receptors, right? Mechanosensory receptors, what are those? Stretch-activated ion channels, that they play a role in actually helping to develop muscle and keeping muscle functioning. And isn't that interesting? So you begin to think, oh, use again, right? Use again, where if you sit in your couch potato, then that atrophy that occurs, maybe it's partly to do with not even moving the muscles, not activating the stretch-activated channels, that massage can actually have some developmental aspects to that muscle. But they're finding out it might actually help other muscles that you're not even massaging. Now, that's pretty cool. Now, you can try to convince your significant other that you need massages all the time to get your muscles growing, you know, so that, you know, doesn't work, I found out. All right. So that's pretty neat to think about. And then you wonder why and what are they doing? They've actually, Esther DuPont has actually looked at exomes. Remember exomes that we talked about? They're not the synaptic vesicles, but the muscle can have these little vesicles that fuse to the plasma membrane and then come off as a vesicle. Don't get confused. Vesicles and synaptic transmission do not go across the synaptic cleft to bind those receptors. These are exomes that will travel in the blood and go to other tissues in your body. So they think the massage increases the exomes that are released and that they can travel in the bloodstream and maybe impact other cells. So that's really cool stuff. And those are in primary papers. They're not in your textbooks yet. They're not in the medical textbooks yet, but they're in primary papers. So this is really quite neat stuff that's probably going to be changing the way people treat people as well. Really cool stuff. Okay, so then we have this cell that's around the basal lamina is around it, and satellite cells can sit underneath. And those can divide and then be incorporated in the muscle cell, and then they make a daughter cell that just stays there that can be completely rejuvenated all the time. And then you decrease with these with age as well. But pretty neat to think about. Okay, so we see all these. So let's make sure that we have this down. You do want to, and the best way to study, really, for exams, is take out a blank piece of paper and draw things out, right? And that way you really understand what you're doing. So if you could take a blank piece of paper out when you're studying and see that you can draw the elements of a skeletal muscle, a sarcomere, and then label it, then you know if you really have it down pat, okay? That's the best way. So if we think of a muscle, and then the muscle fibers inside, right? So take a chunk of muscle, look at the muscle fibers, and remember that muscle fibers are a single cell. So muscle fibers are a single cell. Inside of the muscle fibers, you have a myofibril. That's a unit inside of the single cell, right? And these are what grow with your muscle growth, right? You're going to add more of these myofibrils inside of your cell, the muscle cell. So you're not really adding new cells. You're increasing the size with inside of the cell. And if we look at one of the myofibrils, there's this very interesting banding pattern. And people noted that a long time ago. And then they tried to figure out, how is muscle working? You could look at it in a fish. You can look at it in an amphibian. You can look at it in humans. You can look at it in an insect. They all have the same kind of banding pattern in skeletal muscle. So when the comparative anatomists were looking at it, they thought, this is unique in muscle, skeletal muscle. And then you look at cardiac muscle, and it has some of this kind of banding pattern too, but not the same way. A little bit different. We'll talk about it. But it's interesting, and then it's not, well, we've got to understand the mechanisms of how this muscle works. But remember, back a long time ago, they didn't have, you know, fancy electron microscopes and all that, or maybe even electrophysiology type of equipment. So what they did early on, they saw these muscles that had this banding pattern, they stretched it, and they saw this banding pattern change. They fixed it and did sections. They could do sections through this fiber. And then they could stimulate it with electrical stimulation to see that it shortens, and then fix it, and then do sections again. And from those sections, they came up with how the muscle actually works and how it functions. And even today, we're still using the basic fundamentals that they described way back a long time ago with just good anatomy. Okay, we'll go through some of that. But just to rehash this, you know, muscle fibers, myofibril, you look at the myofibril, and then you see this nice banding pattern. And we'll go over the banding pattern in a little bit. But we've got to know the banding pattern. It's one of those things you've got to memorize. And on standardized exams, if you are going to take those, this is likely going to be on those, okay? Okay, so another way to look at this, and you think about those cross-sections that we talked about. If you take those cross-sections, look what would happen if you cross-sectioned right here. You just see this large glob in the middle, right? If you take a cross-section through here, way over on the edge, you see what's around that glob. If you take a cross-section here, through the middle, plus all these little fingers that are going around, then you can see that it circulates around that glob in the middle. And then, with contraction and relaxation, they could see that these units came closer together, and so then they made the idea about what they call the sliding filament hypothesis. And there's so much detail in this right now that there's computational models to understand how muscle moves. One of the people that's actually very famous for doing this is right over here in our physiology department, Ken Campbell. He actually builds computational models of how the actin in the myosin heads interact and cause contraction. And he builds these three-dimensional conformational models and works on the kinetics of it as well. And so if we look at that middle part, and we're going to come back to it, we're just going to talk about some of the elements within muscle. But that middle part of the muscle that we were showing, that glob that I referred to, is a myosin filament. So it's referred to as a myosin. And it's really interesting because if you break up this myosin, if you put in glycerol, it'll break up and you can see the individual units. What's really neat, if you've done this in a high school lab maybe or something, anybody do that? Glycerol? No? Okay. Then you can actually take it out of glycerol, put it in like a buffer solution, and what's really amazing about myosin, it will reform this. It's phenomenal. Myosin is just amazing. So they found this out earlier, and this is really cool. You can break up myosin with glycerol, wash the glycerol away, and it reforms this kind of structure on itself. That's amazing. So what's really neat about this is you have these individual myosin molecules. They form this globular unit, and you see the little heads in here? And they're going the opposite direction. So these little heads with their tails line up, and they're like little hooks. So when they bind, they can pull, they can ratchet, right? They can ratchet. So anything that attaches to them is going to slide over the myosin. So this is why it's called the sliding filament hypothesis, but really it's standard. It's like a law from that first exam questions that we've had, right? So kind of get an idea of what it looks like, you know, some other aspects. There's lots of proteins in muscle. We're going to talk about some of the main ones, but pretty neat to look at, and different ways to stain up these muscle units in there. So just some nice scanning microscopy that you can see how these muscles look like and that the other proteins that are around it. Now, here's a good picture to kind of think about. Here's a satellite cell. Here's the Z-disc, which we're going to talk about a little bit, and that satellite cell, how big it is. And then this figure over here is really quite neat. So a muscle that's then stained up, and you can just stain it with a stain that stains proteins dark, and then you can see where there's higher protein levels. So there's an A band. There's this band in the middle, which is, we're going to talk about this M line. And then there's this band that goes between the A bands, from this A band to that A band, which is called an I band. There's also this H zone and these Z discs. So why do they call these the Z discs? Let's look at some of these other pictures here coming up. So why do they call these the Z discs? The names, some of these come from German names, but the Z disc looks like a Z. It goes back and forth, so it's like a Z. And if you picked another muscle out from some animal that maybe we found on Mars, let's say, and it had a big Z-disc, really thick, compared to another muscle in the animal that had a real thin Z-disc, you might make some predictions. So hold that thought when we get to some more of this anatomy, then it might all come together. So the Z-disc is where actin units attach. Right, so there's actin units attached to the Z-disc. Those actin units go over the myosin part for a little bit. You can see it right here. It ends here. So this actin goes from here to here. And the myosin goes from here to here. So the myosin is the A-band. The actin, from attaching the Z-disc, can go and slide over the A-band. So that can, you know, you'll see that change. But then it goes from here to here. We call that another band. All right. So that's the I band. So when you're drawing this out in your blank piece of paper, the best thing is to draw three sarcomeres. Draw three sarcomeres because this is where people make a mistake every year. They forget that the I band, they'll draw it from here to here, and that's not the I band. The I band is from here to here. And it's shown here, but it's just beginning over here. So you could draw from here to here, the I-band, not just half of the I-band, okay? Unless you label it half I-band, then that you get points, okay? So if you want to do that, that's fine. But you might get a short answer on this test, you know, something to fill in and draw. So the M-line is in the middle, or they might call it M-line, right in the middle of this actin. And that's interesting because if we go back to the actin, this is why this sometimes gets confusing. That's shown when you shine light on it. It doesn't have the heads. so it looks like it's not as thick, right? So it shows up when you stain it. This region right here is the same as this region right here in the M line, okay? So the myosin heads are going off that way and going off that way, and that's that little region in between, okay? Got it? Kind of. I know it's a little confusing. But these kind of help looking at this in different ways, so that's why it's put up there. But try to get that down, if you will, you know, the sarcomere, all right? So myosin in the middle, Z-disc, and actin. So if you think about all that, you know, another visual, think of the pen like the myosin, and my fingers like the actin, and my thumbs like the Z-disc, right? And on my fingers are these little ratchets, little spots, that on the pen has these little ratchet, little heads that can attach. And then if they attach and there's contraction, it slides over the pen, right? So it's a sliding filament hypothesis. So is the myosin changing in length at all when it contracts? No. So does the A-band change when the muscle contracts? That's the question on exams, right? Does the A-band change when the muscle contracts? The A-band's not changing because it's the myosin. Now, does the I-band change? Right? So the I-band's changing, right? Z-disc to Z-disc, the distance from Z-disc to Z-disc, would that change?
So right. What did you say is in the I-band? So the A-band is myosin.
The A-band's myosin. The I-band is from the end of one myosin to the end of the other myosin across the Z-disc. Right? So it's primarily the actin, but it has a Z-disc in between. Okay? And the H is that little spot between the myosin, the actins on each side that you can see in the middle. And then the M line is not shown here, but it's that line that would be right down the middle where I showed you on the slide before where the myosin heads can't bind. You know, this little M line right there. Okay, so it's kind of neat. Well, if we look back at here, here's a really neat aspect, and this is what people do, like Ken Campbell. He actually looks at single muscle fibers and stimulates them and watches how much they contract, and you can actually measure the force of single muscle fibers. So then you can add up how many muscle fibers are in a muscle, and then you get the total force of that muscle, how much it can generate. And then you wonder, if somebody had a disease, is it in the nerve releasing transmitter? Is it in the acetylcholine receptors? Is it in the vesicle part? Is it not having enough vesicles? Do you have myasthenia gravis or something like that, right? Antibodies to your acetylcholine receptors? Or is it in the contractile elements? Or is it in calcium regulation inside of the muscle that we're going to talk about? All these different components. So what they do is if somebody has a bad muscle, for example, they can take a muscle biopsy and then put it in and isolate the single muscle fiber and then do experiments on it and tell you where the problems are. So it's pretty cool.
So I'm trying to visualize this. So would this image be the horizontal to
it's like this. This is just really small. These are Z-discs. So you're looking at that kind of image right on top of this. It's just that these images are really blown out, right?
Right.
Okay. If you did a cross-section, you're going to see those. You're going to see these things if you do a cross-section through there.
So where those letters are, is that, would that be the top of that like larger picture you had, or would that be like in the middle because it would be turned on its side?
No, it's the same. So these are the Z-disc. And so if we go ahead and we see that, where is it? Right here. These are the Z-disc.
Okay.
It's just really condensed,
okay.
Small. Okay? So that's kind of where we are. Pretty cool stuff. All right. So know this figure. Hint, hint, know this figure. Let's say it 100 times. But, you know this figure well. And understand which bands shorten and lengthen with muscle contraction or muscle lengthening. Okay, and you know how they came about. So let's look at each one of these little units. So if we look at the actin, for example, that's these little blue lines right here, right? That attached to the fetus, we look at the actin now. On the actin is something really neat. In mammals, there's this other protein called tropomyosin, and then attached to tropomyosin are these troponin complexes. So we can break this down. You notice the actin is actually like a helix. It's like two strands, and then the tropomyosin is another winding strand. I think the easiest way to think about this is to take like big rope, right? A big rope, two big ropes, and twist them together. And then you take some smaller ropes, and you kind of twist them together, and you lay them in between the grooves of the bigger ropes. And that's the way to kind of picture this. So this is what's happening there. On the troponins, we're just going to hit some of the main points. There's three troponins that we should know. Troponins C, I, and T. And there's some exceptions to this, but generally, troponin C binds calcium. Okay? Now, there's some other aspects to this too, but generally, troponin C. So it's really easy to remember. C for calcium, right? And you won't forget this. Okay. So what happens inside of that unit? We'll go through this over and over again in different ways. I just want you to see the individual components. If we look at the myosin is amazing. So that's the little units that come together and make that A band. It's also woven together with two strands. This is the tail region and then the head region. So it's this alpha helix, right? And then the myosin head is what they call light chains. This is where you can actually stain up for different types of myosin. This is where your differentiation in fast and slow muscle comes from also. And on that myosin light chain, this is where you have activity, ATPase activity, where you can cleave ATP, which is really quite neat too. So this is the activity of that muscle, how fast it can cleave ATP. And so that's kind of neat. So those little myosin heads can move. They have a bending, a hinge right there. They can move. People break these up with enzymes, and you can separate out these types of myosins, and you can put them on a gel, and you can stain, right? And you can have banding patterns. And you can tell fast muscle, slow muscle, by these different banding patterns. And you can even stain them for different activity of ATPase activity and see how fast they break down ATP. Right? So what would you expect? Slow muscle, fast muscle. Which one's going to break down ATP faster and, you know, one slower? Why is a fast muscle fast? How is it that a fast muscle is fast? Why do we call a fast muscle fast? Generally, any ideas? Yeah. The name, it's fast. But why is it fast? Because it can relax and contract fast. That's why it's fast. That's why we call it fast. Slow muscle can do that, but slower. And slow muscle doesn't fatigue as fast as fast muscle does. Fast muscle is going to fatigue fast. We'll come back to that over and over again a little bit as we go along. And I already told you that you could disassociate the myosin and take away the glycerol, and it will come right back to its unit. So that's pretty neat. So we go back to a long time ago. Albert St. Georgi. It's one of those gods again. Albert St. Georgi was a phenomenal person. He got the Nobel Prize, and we might think about, when you think about the Nobel Prize for vitamin C, who do you think about right away? No? No one thinks about it. Okay. Vitamin C. Anybody else? There were two Nobel Prizes for vitamin C. Isn't that bizarre? Two Nobel Prizes for vitamin C. One was Albert St. Georgi. Anybody know who the other person was that got the Nobel Prize for vitamin C? You know, don't you, Samina? Vitamin C? Nobel Prize? No? Sorry. Okay. We'll just hold that for you to look it up on Wikipedia. Do a Wikipedia. Anybody got their computer open, they can do a Wikipedia search, vitamin C, Nobel Prizes. Let us know. Who's going to do it fast? Somebody up there in the back, maybe. Is he working on it? Are you working on it back there? Vitamin C, Nobel Prize. Oh, yes. Linus Pauling. Good. Remember that name. See, Linus Pauling. We should know him. And Albert St. Georgi. So look at the time that Albert St. Georgi got this. Quite early, right? 1937. Albert St. Georgi was a phenomenal person. He was from Hungary originally, and then he had problems with World War II and Germany and all that good stuff, that crazy things that happened back then. And he got the Nobel Prize in 1937 with that, but he should have got another Nobel Prize for his work in muscle. But he did so many things in the late 1950s. Look, he was working on cancer, and he was actually looking at the quantum mechanics, stuff you purged in your chemistry and physics class, related to the biochemistry of cancer. And he really made some good breakthroughs there early on. But one of his key work was also understanding, let's see, where did that go to? It's right here somewhere. Right here. 1938, his work on the biophysics of muscle movement. And he found out that muscles contain actin, which then combines with the protein myosin and the energy source ATP. So he actually was the one that realized that actin and myosin were inside muscle. He isolated, like with glycerol, and then he realized that ATP was actually a key with it as well. So way back in the early 1940s and 1930s is when he worked on this stuff. So it's pretty amazing things. So that's part of that. Okay. And so he isolated all that. Now you get the idea of here's this contracting sarcomere. So a sarcomere, remember, defined sarcomeres from Z disc to Z disc. So the length of a sarcomere is from Z disc to Z disc. Sarcomere shortened because of the sliding filament hypothesis. And the sliding filament, you can see here. Well, if the top band is stretched out, and then as you stimulate it, we'll talk about the stimulation, the actin overlaps with the myosin. And here you can see that the two actins from each side, the Z disc, and the actin, right here, they're actually almost going to touch. But what's going to happen if you contract it more? And this is usually not in the physiological range for mammals, but you can do this experimentally. If you contract it even more, the actin starts to overlap. But what happens then? If the actin heads were here and here, but they start to interact with each other, now you're not going to have as many actin heads binding because they're interfering with each other, right? You can't have as many actin heads. So think about an actin head binding. Like if we had a rope, a tug-of-war rope, we could have a rope in here, right? We get a half the class on that side of the rope and half the class on this side of the rope, and you pull on it back and forth, right? And your hands are like the myosin, and like the myosin heads, right? And you're pulling on that actin back and forth. Well, what's going to happen? You want an even contraction, right? So that shortens nice and evenly. And then you think about, well, what if somebody comes in involves and starts pulling off some of those people on the rope, right? You're not having that interaction. So what's going to happen to the force that's being generated? It's going to decrease, right? Because you don't have as many myosin heads acting on the actin, like that tug-of-war rope. So this is what happens, and this is how this next figure comes about. So this next figure is looking at sarcomere length for an individual sarcomere, okay, and relative tension. Now, this is with maximum force. That's at one point, not moving, it's static. There's a little subtlety to that, but it's okay, just the general point here. Let's look at the physiological range of most mammals' muscles are right around in here to here, okay? If you've overstretched your muscle, you probably damaged it. Okay, so usually around here to here for mammals in the normal physiological range. Well, let's see what happens if we stretch it all the way out. Of course, it's going to be long, right? It's long. But as it contracts and as the action slides over the myosin, and the myosin heads are ratcheting this way and ratcheting that way on the tug-of-war rope, what happens to tension? It's going to go up, right? And then, as they reach their maximum number of myosin heads, you reach the maximum amount of tension. But what's really interesting is it can shorten a little bit more, because what happens in that M zone? There's no myosin heads, right? But the actin can still move together, but there's no more myosin heads interacting. So actually, you can shorten a little bit more, but the tension doesn't change. But now, when the actins start to overlap and interfere with each other, what's going to happen to tension? It starts to drop down, okay? And this range is not that common for mammals. Now, there's some unusual animals that have this ability to super shorten. Some of them are just amazing. And I won't get too involved with that because it's too much for us. But the thing is that's really neat is some barnacles actually can super shorten their muscles, and they actually have holes in the Z-disc. So what happens is the actin can actually go through the Z-disc and super shorten. But that means the myosin has to really crunch up, but it can have a super shortened muscle super contract and then have long. So that's pretty neat too. It can really have a long sarcomere, but a super short one too in contraction. So you can see and you wonder about the advantages and disadvantages of all that. We could talk about it more if you'd like to. But not all the let's go back to this thing real fast. Not all the muscles have the same arrangement. If you look at it in a comparative aspect, some of these numbers of actin around the myosin vary depending on the animal species. So generally we see it like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but in some animals it might be 7, it might be 9, it all depends on the animal, but for our purposes, just know that these are the actin, and that's the myosin, and then there's heads that bind to it. But this is why there's some variation that you might hear about sometime about the number of actin around the myosin. It makes a difference. There's computational models for all that. So, neat experiments that were done that you're doing in the lab this week, right, is to stimulate the muscle. And then you can measure the force of that muscle contraction. But you can stimulate it in two different ways, right? You could stimulate it by the nerve going to the muscle, but then you have to look at synaptic transmission in that case, or you could stimulate the muscle directly. What are you doing in the lab? You're stimulating the nerve? Everybody's doing that? Monday group? Don't know what we did. We just did it. So you're stimulating the nerve, which is a little bit different, right? Because now you have to have an action potential down the nerve, release transmitter, has to have the right calcium in the bath, all the good stuff, and then goes across the synaptic cleft, binds to what type of receptors on the muscle? Frog muscles? What type of nicotinic receptors? Acetylcholine, but of a subtype of cholinergic, but they're cholinergic, but you got two different divisions of cholinergic systems. Nicotinic and muscarinic. What type are these? Nicotinic, because nicotine also activates them, right? So these are nicotinic, and then that opens up the channel that we're going to talk about for muscle contraction causes muscle to contract. All right, so you can look at this muscle contraction. You can measure the tension force of that, and you can actually, when you're stimulating, you might see something like that blue curve at the very top. All right? But if you don't stimulate, what happens if you just pull on muscle and you measure the tension? Of course, these little heads are on there, right? And you're pulling on the muscle, and there's lots of connective tissue in there. So that gives what they call passive tension. So this is the passive tension without stimulating. At some point, you're stretching on the muscle, and you can imagine you take that muscle and you pull on it, you're going to have some tension at some point until you start damaging it, right? But that's a passive tension. You can subtract that away from the active tension and then just get the active curve of what happens when you stimulate muscle directly. Okay, question?
Yeah, so when the actin slides over each other, is it the actin heads or the myosin?
Well, the... Yes, I mean, there's the myosin heads. I might have said that. Only the myosin has heads. Okay. The actin has binding sites for the myosin heads, which we'll talk about. It's the myosin heads on the actin. But if the actin starts to overlap, then you can't have as many sites for the myosin heads to bind to.
I noticed you said something about enough calcium in the bath. That was there. Well, wait. We can't do quiz questions yet because not everyone's paying it.
Yes. Okay. So there's a quiz question about calcium or something, right?
Yeah.
Yes. But we'll talk about it in lectures. We've been talking about it in lectures. Because it's also in the PowerPoints and it's also in the textbook. People will read ahead and all that good stuff. Okay, so think about these sarcomeres and the change sources. Now, what was that passive tension due to? This is really neat. This is not in the textbooks yet, but it's in some textbooks but not others. Now look at a little bit more detail of this sarcomere. Here's your M-band. What's the thick filament made out of?
Myosin.
So that's called thick filament because it's really thick. Remember, thick myosin. Then the Z-disc and the little fingers that come off the Z-disc, those are called thin filaments. And the thin filament is actin, right? Actin. And you see that actin coming off. But what's this new thing that we haven't seen before? What's this new structure in there that's just bizarre? Uh-oh, I don't know what that thing is. What is this blue thing with this little yellow? And it's attached to the myosin over here. You see this? We didn't talk about that yet, right? Anybody cover that in cell biology or some other class? No?
Is it titan?
It's right there. It says it's titan. And what does titan refer to? kind of mythological titan, right? Anybody study Greek mythology? Titan, right? Titan, the sea god, right? The strength. So titan is the largest protein in your body. Isn't that amazing? And they missed it for many, many years. Because when they dissolved up muscle and they ran it on the gel, it was so big it stayed at the top. And they didn't see it migrate down into the gels when they were running like gel electrophoresis. And it wasn't until somebody said, well, what is all that protein that's staying at the top? And then they described it and isolated it and found out, whoa, it is a protein that is inside the muscle, but we never classified it yet. And so we better figure out what this is. And they found out it was the largest protein that you have in your body, as far as I know. Correct me if I'm wrong. Look it up somewhere. Wikipedia. And then it binds to the Z-disc, and it binds to the myosin to help keep that conformation. So when we talk about passive tension now, they think it's really due to the titin. And what's interesting about titin is that it actually can interact with the actin. There's different theories about how that, or different hypotheses, I should say, about how this titin and its structures actually work on the Z-disc and if there's some interaction with the actin. Some models actually show the titin wrapping around like a little spring that can wrap around and attach with the actin. And that's another idea that people have. So it's kind of interesting because now people are looking at it on a comparative aspect and they're finding out every animal they're looking at with skeletal muscle has a form of titin. But in some animals, it's much different than in others. And they're actually able to isolate titin and these structural components from the weirdest animal where they can get an X-ray crystallography from, and it's actually opening up the field for understanding humans. It's from the tarantula skeletal muscle. Is that not bizarre? The tarantula skeletal muscle is offering this ability to actually isolate these proteins really well. They're very stable. And you can get an X-ray crystallography of these proteins. And so it's actually opening up of how our muscles work by looking at tarantulas that you want to step and kill and not play with, right? So it's pretty interesting about these aspects. More will come. Now, if we think about the outside of the muscle fiber, just a little bit to think about, it's really quite amazing, right? And we won't get into, let's go forward maybe. Okay. So if you look at the muscle, you know, the skeletal contractile elements of muscle, like this right here, here's your muscle, here's your plasma membrane, these are nerves innervating it, and this is one of your favorite preparations, which is crayfish. Right, crayfish. But then how does this muscle connect in with the plasma membrane and of the basal lamina of the cell, right? Is it just a contractile element inside of this cell? I mean, how does it interact with the cell membrane, right? And that's where we go back to this aspect. So here's your cell membrane. Look at the amount of proteins that are involved in the cell membrane. So these are in your cell membrane. These are number of proteins that are identified in that fluid mosaic model, right? And then these are going outside into the basal lamina and interacting. It's phenomenal, the number of proteins that are involved in your skeletal muscle that help that contractile element stay attached to the plasma membrane, but then even the plasma membrane to the collagen on the outside. So and people have collagen disorders, and people that, there's different kinds of diseases. Maybe somebody's heard of the butterfly syndrome with people, babies, for example. Anybody hear butterfly syndrome? Mm-hmm. Really a bad problem. They have a disease, the collagen doesn't work right in their skin, for example, and their skin makes blisters all over it all their life, and it's really just a miserable disorder for them. It's somewhat of a genetic disorder, and they basically can't move because it hurts all the time. If they have to change their dressing because they get infected and infections, and PT, physical therapy, has to give them exercise, right, so their muscles don't atrophy, but it hurts so much for them to do. Usually what they do is they take an anesthesiologist, put the child asleep, and then put them in the water bath so they can change the dressing because it's so painful for them. And then wake them back up. And can you imagine being anesthetized all the time, every time you need your dressing changed? But it's so painful to them. But it's a collagen disorder with the skin, and it starts to make blisters all over. I know it sounds gross, right? But lucky, you know, how lucky you are, you think about things, how lucky. And then we think about this other disorder. So here's inside of the muscle, it's a little bit different than that other picture. Here's the plasma membrane. Look at dystrophin. This is binding to the contractile elements to the plasma membrane. What kind of disorder do you think this is related to? Dystrophin.
Muscular dystrophy.
Right? So there's different forms of muscular dystrophy. And the biggest problem is that they have loose muscles, right? And they don't have a lot of strength in their muscles, and their muscles are going to atrophy. And it's different forms of muscular dystrophy because different disorders where this dystrophin molecule might be damaged, but it could be here or it could be in this dystrophin complex. So now they're isolating different forms of muscular dystrophy to pinpoint exactly where the problems are in their makeup. Is it the dystrophin complex? Is it the dystrophin molecule that binds to the contractile elements down here that helps hold all that inside the cell? So I don't want you to have to memorize all those proteins. Don't worry about that. But to understand there's a lot more to that muscle that's usually in the textbooks. It's not just the contractile element. It's that contractile element that binds to the plasma membrane, that plasma membrane that binds to the collagen that's outside the plasma membrane. All of that's very important for the muscle health. And then we add on, that's not even on here, ion channels in your receptors, right? And then we just talked about the massage with stretch-activated ion channels. So now they're finding the stretch-activated ion channels throughout the muscle as well. That's pretty cool also, right? So there's lots of interesting aspects with skeletal muscle. Okay, so let's look at this little muscle over here. What did we say about you if you don't exercise, your arms in a cast, for example? Your muscles atrophy very quick, right? If you cut the nerve to your skeletal muscle, within 20 minutes, your skeletal muscle will start to atrophy. 20 minutes without the nerve will start to atrophy. But with the nerve, what do you have? Some spontaneous release of vesicles, right, that helps keep the muscle going too. So there's something really amazing about the nerve-to-muscle interaction. We'll talk more about that as well. Okay, so that's kind of neat. This is a favorite muscle prep of your crayfish, healthy muscle. This is a muscle that allows that big claw to be raised. This is called a levator muscle. But remember, crustaceans like lobsters and crayfish and crabs, you can pinch on their leg. They have a little spot called an anatomy plane, like a lizard's tail. They can throw off their leg, and they can regrow a new one. So after 3 months, when that leg was pinched off, what happens? It doesn't have that big arm to lift up anymore. So what happens to the muscle on the side? It starts to atrophy. But then as the limb grows back, then it starts to use it again, and then it's going to lay it back in again. So this is one side that was healthy. This is the other side after 3 months after it atrophied from an adult crayfish, and you take them off. And look at the muscle units. Those are the same ones. These are like this. But look how small they got here. Very small little muscle fibers. So it's amazing. But then you wonder, well, then what happens to the nerves? If the nerve is innervating those muscles, releases transmitter, causes the muscle to contract, depolarize it, but it's atrophying, do you want the same amount of transmitter to be released? Do you need to kind of regulate how much transmission you might have? You might not need the same strength, right? And the muscle's atrophying. What would happen if you, tried to contract it while the muscle's atrophying? And think, when that muscle atrophies, all those other proteins, are they atrophying too? Are they disappearing? What's happening to all these, right? The contractile element's disappearing, and the muscle's getting smaller. What regulates that? Where do those proteins go, right? They're down-regulated somehow. By disuse? Are they ubiquinated and then being torn down in a, what's that structure called inside the cell that eats up proteins?
Spliceosome,
right, thanks. Eating it up, and then how is it doing it on one side and not the other side, but how many proteins and which proteins are being degraded? Are they all being degraded at the same rate? But you still need to contract a little bit, it still needs to move, it still needs to grow back again. That's just phenomenal, right? So this is what people are trying to study in aspects. So it's pretty neat to think about this. And then the innervation pattern. So like you, you're a little one with little muscles, and you're contracting, right? And you need to lift up the ball to go play. But then when you get older, you might be lifting a brick or your animal physiology textbook that's real heavy, right? And you need to contract more.
does the innervation stay the same? Do you have more innervation? How does it regulate the amount of synaptic transmission for that muscle as the muscle grows? Because as the muscle grows, what happens? Lambda, right, all that conduction that we talked about along the muscle fiber, it has to maintain the contraction that we're going to talk about. And then it has to match that. So that's what we'll cover on Thursday, too. But in the meantime, let's do something really fun. If we can borrow your phone, that would be great. And we can put it up here. We'll show everybody. Fun things. We've got to do fun things. So now we need a victim with small arms. Maybe. Can we have a victim? Somebody won't hurt you. You'd love it, wouldn't you? I can just tell you're ready for this. So it only hurts a little. Not too bad. Okay. Whoops. Can we use your... either... Can we use maybe your biceps? Is that all right? Oh, yeah. I mean, you can operate this, can't you? These are really cool. Here's your plug-in. Wait, oops, static electricity. Just a little shock, is that okay?
Okay.
Okay. She's a good player. Okay. It just works easier on the muscles like yours. Okay, so what we're doing is we have this little thing right here. And you see, notice the little cockroach that's on there? Right? Can you see the cockroach? Yes, there's a little cockroach. It's Backyard Brain's symbol. Because they take the legs off the cockroach, you'll notice that one of the legs is missing on the cockroach. So these guys were actually working in their basement, and they came up with making electrophysiology equipment cheap for people, and they can go to middle schools and high schools and all this kind of stuff. So you notice this isn't plugged into anything. It's all self-contained. And you just have the iPhone here, which I guess is on, right?
Yeah.
And can everybody see that okay? And you can do some fun things with it, like that. And then I'm going to take this little microphone, and she's going to contract her biceps. All right, now try it again. Is that not cool? Go for it. Now, if she just holds it there as long as she can, we can find out how long she can do this, and we can measure fatigue. Can we do the whole of next 15 minutes, and then we don't have to have any more lecture? Motivator, 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 motivator. Let's find out what fatigue is. She's fatiguing. All right, well, that's great. All right, thank you very much. All right. And
it
didn't hurt too much, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for your phone. I appreciate it. Thanks, both of you. Great. But you might have to peel these off because leave a little, like a little redness because of the salt that's on there. All right. Yay, bananas. All right. So what did we just look at? We looked at, this is Backyard Brains. Look it up online. They have a great website. It's really hilarious stuff that they have there. Actually, you can buy the little kit for like $35, and they give you the resistors and capacitors. And there's a middle school that we've worked with where they can actually solder it together and make their own little board. So they learn about soldering and putting the resistors and capacitors on. They tell you how to do it. And then they test it on like cockroach legs or their own cells. And there's all different things that you can do with these little kits now they're making. Or you can just buy the kit already pre-made, like for $80 or something. But you can go to schools and do fun things, torture relatives that bug you again in the summer and you want them not to come back again. You can do things. All right, so you get the idea of what we covered on that part. What was it that we just measured? Electrical activity, right? What could we call this electrical activity? Bioelectricity, right? Bioelectricity. What does it do to? Why did we measure this electric activity? No different than the EKG. We recorded an EMG from extracellular recording. It was an EMG, electromyogram. Well, how can you record electrical events? What has to happen for the electrical event to happen? You're not a wire, so it's not the electron itself, you know, as like moving down the wire, but what's moving? Ions that are charged, right? So an ion that's charged moves across the membrane, and then that's what we're picking up, and that then picks up that electricity. No different than an EEG on your head picking up the ion movements across the cells that are active, all right? Okay, so we're going to get into that a little bit, too, about that electricity aspect. I was going to do some drawing stuff with this, but we'll wait on Thursday with that, and so we can cover some of this to make sure that the drawings will work well. So on Thursday, we're going to have an activity that we're going to work on. So two types of muscle contraction that we generally refer to. There's some other subdivisions, but the general points that we're going to talk about is isometric and isotonic. And this can appear on standardized exams, too, so remember this. So isometric means iso, the same. Metric, what does that mean? Versus isotonic. Isometric is the same length, right? Metric, like meter. So the same length. And isotonic is the same weight on it. So how to recognize the difference of these? So let's think you're picking up a barbell of weights, right, from the ground. You're not able to move them yet, but you're contracting your muscles, the biceps, right? You're contracting them, but the barbell's not moving yet. You're trying to contract, right? You're building up a force, but the whole muscle is not really shortening yet, right? It's not, the barbell's not moving. So what is that? That's isometric. Now, you pick the barbell up, and you're starting to move it. The barbell weighs the same, and your muscle is shortening. That's the isotonic, okay? So that helps build muscles, right? Exercise. How about the people in space, on the space station? What's happening to them? They can't lift barbells, right? They don't weigh anything. So what happened with the cosmonauts? The Russians actually were very good about physiological and medicine in space way before NASA really kicked on with it. And a lot of what NASA learned was from the Russians and the work that they did on their cosmonauts. But what do they now do in space? You might have seen that on the space station. They're not lifting barbells. What are they doing? What do you think? How do you keep muscles healthy? The big problem was muscles were atrophying in space, right? And they came back down, they couldn't walk. The first cosmonauts had to be carried out of their capsule because their muscles were so weak. And then they started exercise regimes. And, well, you could exercise by pushing on the wall, right? Have a back against the wall and push against the other wall, right? But then they started doing exercises on their own, like pushing against themselves, right? But now they use, like, rubber bands. And so that's pretty neat. And you might have seen the bicycle they have up on the space station. There's no seat on it, really, but they're kind of biking on this thing that moves the muscles, and they can set different resistances on it. So they've really changed a lot. But a lot of the early work, they actually took muscle biopsies. They saw the atrophy and all this, and so they now have exercise regimes for the cosmonauts and astronauts that have to spend time up in space. So it's really quite neat about the whole problem. What's another problem in space in general? It's not just zero gravity. That's kind of a minor. That's a problem, but it's the bigger problem is what? Remember the twin that went up, Kelly, right? Came back down. He shrank a little bit too. But the other aspects, what's up in space? It's a real big problem. It's not just a zero gravity. It's the radiation, right? And the radiation damage that people get. And so that's a big problem, is the radiation exposure. Okay, so we kind of talked about this, lifting the weight. And if you're lifting a heavy weight, you can't really move your muscle, right? So the Vmax is very low. You lift less weight, you can move it faster. That's the main take-home of this aspect. Now, the region for calcium. And you might have done this in your experiments. Did you have, you had calcium in your bath, right? No calcium in the bath? When you did it on Monday? But in that saline, do you know the composition of the saline anywhere?
That was a good question. That was my question.
That would be a good question. So if you didn't have any calcium in there, what's going to happen to synaptic transmission if you're stimulating the nerve? Are you going to get synaptic transmission? Not evoked. You might get minis, but you're not going to get evoked, right? So it wouldn't do anything if you had zero calcium, right? And if you, so that could be an issue. But if you have contraction, then you know the calcium's around because that's the only way you're going to get transmitted to be released with evoked transmission.
So if you have calcium around, and you have to have ATP, we're going to come back to why this is important, and then you can get muscle tension. You take away the calcium, and it drops down, but ATP is still present. So the higher the calcium concentration, the more force you can get, but then it's going to plateau off. All right? How does all this work? Well, remember those units that we talked about, the tropomyosin and the troponins, and you have different types of troponins? What does C bind to?
Calcium.
Calcium. And then you have I and T. T is like the tail that interwoves between the tropomyosin that holds these troponins' heads on the actin. Don't get confused. This is not myosin. This is on the actin, right? The tropomyosin wraps around the actin, and then these troponin T's are interwoven in here, and this is the troponin complex. So, actin, tropomyosin, the troponin T is kind of interwoven. So what's really interesting about this is there's an active site on the actin that's going to be exposed when the troponin C head moves away. When the troponin moves away, it exposes this active site. It's like another little myosin head in a sense, but not as big as that big myosin head. But it's not really generating any force. All it's doing is hiding the active site. How does the active site get exposed? It binds calcium. Conformational change exposes an active site, and then myosin can bind to this active site. We'll come back. Well, we can go through this now. So ATPase activity is very important too. As this contracts, you need the ATP to be generated, and we'll pull these two together in a little bit, but it's actually calcium dependent as well. So we'll look at this in another way too. Let's just go through some of these figures. These are kind of classic figures. So if you have calcium present, look at the top of the graph, calcium present, and you add the ATP, boom, you can get muscle contraction. Now look at there. You take away the calcium, and you still have the contraction there. But one thing that you've done is you remove the ATP. So if you remove ATP, your muscles are still contracted, right? It's kind of neat. And then you add ATP, and then all of a sudden it relaxes. But it's in the absence of calcium. I know that's a little confusing. There is this really neat experiment that you can do with rabbit muscle. And so you can take rabbit muscle, and you can actually just add ATP there, and then you can add calcium, and you just watch it contract. You can take other rabbit muscle, and you can not have ATP around, add calcium, and you won't get it. So it's kind of a neat experiment to see. The point is, you need ATP to do what? You need ATP to relax the muscle. You also need ATP to help develop the contraction. All right, but you need ATP for contraction. And you need calcium for exposing the active sites so myosin head can bind to it. How is all this confusing? All right, I know it's confusing. Let's go to this point. Where is this? That's too far. Okay, so let's go back to this part, and this might help. Okay, let's stay here, and then we'll answer questions. So, before we go through this in your mind, we're going to draw this out on Thursday. But go through your mind like this, and just kind of keep it straight. Action potential comes down the motor nerve, the skeletal muscle. Action potential comes down. What happens? Opens up voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium comes in, causes vesicles to fuse, right? That fusion of vesicles releases acetylcholine, goes across the synaptic cleft, binds to nicotinic receptors. Those nicotinic receptors are what? Ionotropic receptors. They're an ion channel. They open up, sodium goes in, a little bit of potassium comes out. What does that do? Depolarize the membrane. Now, the next step, which we didn't talk about yet, but we're getting to, that depolarization of the membrane goes down the T-tubules, causes a protein to change its conformation, okay? These dihydropyridine receptors, it's a protein. It changes its conformation from the voltage change. And inside the cell, it's connected with another protein, these ranitidine receptors that are attached to the ER. It's an endoplasmic reticulum, basically, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Pulls the plug out of them. Calcium dumps out inside the cell. That calcium does what? Binds to troponin C, causes a conformational change in troponin C, exposes an active site, and what's waiting to bind to the active site? Myosin heads. So as soon as the active sites are exposed, myosin heads bind, ratchet. How do you stop this from happening? How can we stop this from happening? ATP is needed, and ATP is needed for the heads to come off. So how did you start all this? By calcium. So if you get calcium out, then there's no more active sites. There's no more ability for the myosin heads to bind. How do you get calcium out? Pump it back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum as fast as you can. Right? So you pump it back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Calcium drops. The myosin heads have nothing to bind to because the troponin Cs are back hiding the active sites. And then you can't have it binding. Now, how is it that ATP is related to the myosin heads coming off? You need the ATP to pull the heads back off of the actin binding sites. If not, you get what's kind of like rigor mortis. This is why you're stiff. If you die, you're not making ATP, right? And your muscles, the idea is that the myosin heads are locked in there. You're not making any ATP, so the heads can't come off. So they're stiff. And then as the muscle breaks down from bacteria, then you can move again, right? So the idea is, but some people kind of question some of that, but the idea is that that stiffness that can happen if you don't have oxygen is due to the myosin heads locked in on the actin, called stiff. Body Farm, a great book to read, Body Farm, where they actually looked at dead animals, and the different parts of how the animal died and muscle. Thursday, we're going to hit this again. We're going to finish up probably the muscle chapter on Thursday. A lot there, cardiac, smooth muscle, the whole gamut. Yeah.